They say that the way you want to start a sermon or a message or a speech is always with something gripping. And so I thought, you know, what better way than to start with a civics quiz this morning? So I have a civics quiz question for you. What is the average lifespan of a national constitution? So constitutions are how nations form and say, this is who we are. This is what we're going to be about. This is our purpose, why we exist. So I'm asking you to think about what is the, and those of you at home, don't Google it. What is the average lifespan? Some of you here are Googling it. I know. Average lifespan of a national constitution. Just for frame of reference, the United States Constitution went into effect in 1789. So that gives you a little frame of reference. So without looking up, just one or two people, just give me a guess. How many years do you think? Those of you who are here in first service, I don't want you to say anything either. Let me give it to you because it might be shocking. The average lifespan is 17 years. The average lifespan of a national constitution, the thing that's supposed to hold a nation together, is just 17 years. What does that say about humanity? What does that say about what we're like? And then you look at the United States Constitution, which shapes and holds us together as a union of states. It's the longest running constitution in the history of the world at 231 years. Ours is the longest running constitution that we're still organized under, that still holds us together. And that is a very long time. And that is a testimony to the brilliance of the men who wrote that, along with the Bill of Rights that followed quickly on the heels, and the Declaration of Independence that launched us into that place of having our own constitution. We declared our independence from England with the radical idea, and it was a radical idea for the day, that all men are created equal and have inalienable rights. In other words, rights that no one can take away, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These are the things that are written into the very beginning. These are wise words. It was incredibly wise of them to write the way they did, the way they formed the Constitution. All of them signed their names to these words. They shed their blood for these words. And yet, just like every other beginning of any other nation or group or religion, the beginning was flawed in human messes. There was human mess all around it. And while, for instance, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights set the stage for slavery to be abolished, it was decades before the very people who wrote these things down, who came up with these genius ideas, stopped owning black people and treating them as property. Honestly, it was more than decades. It's something that's still been an issue in our world to this day. Still an issue, still a mess. You don't even have to open the history books to see this kind of thing. You don't even have to read books. You can just go to Disney Channel, right? And you can watch Hamilton, which is a musical that's out on Disney Channel now. None of us could have ever afforded to go watch Hamilton but on Broadway, but now you can just watch it on Disney Channel and you can see the history of our nation. You can see what a mess it was the people were who were part of starting this. And that doesn't negate what they did. That doesn't negate the incredibly wise and heroic things they did. But the reality is that these were also humans like us who are a mess. They were unfaithful, adulterous, unethical. They were violent people. They were people who played politics very dirty. You think politics today are dirty. When in your lifetime have you seen a former vice president shoot and kill a former secretary of the treasury? Never. We've never seen that, right? And the kind of things that went on just show us that even though we were born out of incredibly noble ideas and with genius things were written and the people who put this together were incredibly intelligent and had foresight, and yet they were incredibly broken. We're struggling as a nation right now to reconcile those two, as though they can't stand side by side, but they do stand side by side, just like it stands side by side in you and me. I can do incredibly wise and smart things, and yet I can be incredibly stupid and broken. It's what we're like. It's sin. Incredibly broken people. But what they were trying to do is they were trying to put something together that would hold a union together, hold a union of states together. They were trying to create something that would hold people together. They created systems and laws, and we've been building on those laws for 231 years, all with the goal of, we gotta hold people together, hold these states together, hold the union together. But it seems like no matter how many laws you pass, how many systems you set up, how many times a government transitions and changes and goes through differences, we can never overcome the human messes that get in the way, that make it so difficult to hold people together, to truly unite people as one. Similar to our country, the church started in the middle of human messes as well. Do you remember Jesus' Last Supper with the disciples? Let your mind race back. Jesus' final supper with them. It's the night he's about to be betrayed. He's about to be arrested and murdered on a cross. And Jesus spent that night in that room, an upper room of a house, eating with the disciples and explaining to them that he was going to be going away and they wouldn't be able to go with him, but he was going to leave them the work to carry on what he had begun. That night was the beginning of the transition point that marked the birth of the church. And yet it was born in the middle of human mess. Gathered around that table with Jesus was a bunch of human messes, one of whom would that night betray him, another one that morning would deny knowing him. All of them would run away and leave him and abandon him. It was born in the middle of that human mess. And yet there's something very different about the birth of the church that sets it apart from the birth of our nation, the birth of any other religion, the birth of anything in this world. There's something different that sets it apart that overcomes the human mess, that overcomes the way you and I, people with our selfishness, tear things apart and have such a difficulty really holding together. We're able to achieve peace and unity for periods of time, but we can't hold it together eternally. But something about that night, something happened that made it possible, that sets the church apart as different from everything else. And it's found in the one simple law, the one simple command that Jesus gave to his disciples that night and gave to us that night. John 13:34 says it. Jesus, in the middle of that supper, says to them, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another." And if you're here or at home, you can follow along in the app. The scriptures are there. You can write notes down. "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, you must love one another." Now, that doesn't feel new. Love isn't new, right? We read in the Old Testament about love. What makes this a new command? What makes this different? What makes this command radically new, radically different, and incredibly powerful to unite and hold us together is that second part. What Jesus says, "As I have loved you." And that is encompassing so much that we'll get into in a little bit here. But this isn't Jesus saying, "Come on, guys," like a mom with her children, "would you please just love each other and get along?" Or like a hippie, like, "Come on, everybody, just love each other." Right? That's not what Jesus is doing here. What makes the church so radically different from anything else in this world is not that we're built on love, it's that we're built on Jesus' love. And that's different. It's different than any other kind of love. And what I want us to do today is dig into that, dig into how it's different and the lessons we learn right from this context, right from that room that night about Jesus' love. There's many other lessons to learn about Jesus' love, and over the next several weeks, we're gonna be looking at different passages in scripture about being one another and what that means and what it means to love one another. But tonight, I want us to look at that room and what happened in that room and learn from it what is unique about Jesus' love, what is special about Jesus' love, and let it challenge us to walk out of here and begin to love with Jesus' love in a way maybe we haven't before. So this morning, we're gonna zoom into that room where it all began, and we're gonna learn whatever we can about this incredible love. So picture yourself walking into that room. It's probably a low ceiling, and you see the table in the middle, and there's rugs thrown around and pillows. And that table, it's not a tall table like this or a medium table. There aren't chairs around it. It's a low to the ground table, and everyone would lay on the floor and recline on the pillows with your head up at the table and your feet pointing away from the table, as far from the food, as far from the table as possible, for obvious reasons. Feet are disgusting. Their feet were particularly disgusting, covered in the dirt and the mud and the human and animal filth that lined their streets. You'd walk into a house like this, and usually it was whoever was the new guy, the newest servant in the house, was the one, oh, okay, you, why don't you wash their feet? He's the one who got that job, to wash everyone's feet. But as they're sitting there, Jesus gets up, takes off his outer cloak, wraps a towel around himself, gets a basin of water, and then begins to walk around the perimeter of that table behind them and just take their feet and wash their feet. Can you just imagine this? Scrub away the dirt, dry them with the towel, go to the next person, scrub away the dirt, dry it with the towel. The next person, he gets to Peter, and Peter's like, yo, what are you doing? And Jesus is like, well, I'm gonna wash your feet. And he's like, no, you're Jesus. You're the leader of this group. You're not washing my feet. And Jesus is like, well, I need to, or you're not part of me. And then Peter starts to like practically take off his clothes. And Jesus is like, slow down. I'm just washing your feet. I'm teaching you something. And Jesus said, I'm teaching you a lesson about this is how you love each other. Not by going and just washing feet, but by being a servant to each other. A little bit later that night, food's around and everybody's eating and enjoying it, although I'm sure the atmosphere felt different. And you see Jesus across the table take some bread and stick it in some of the wine and hand it to Judas. Now, that was a sign in their day. If you, you know, share bread that way, that's a sign of brotherhood. That's a sign of closeness. Of relationship. You don't just do that with anybody. You only do that with your closest friends. And so when you see Jesus hand that bread to Judas, you think, oh yeah, you know, we're a close group. And then Judas gets up and Jesus tells him, go do quickly. And Judas heads out to betray Jesus. And after Judas leaves, Jesus starts to talk to them about, hey, in a little while I'm going away. You're not gonna be able to come with me. You won't see me anymore. And Peter interrupts him and says, yo, Jesus, sorry to interrupt again, but no, there's no way I'm letting you out of my sight. I'm gonna be right behind you all the way. I've got your back. There's no way I'm not gonna be with you. So forget about that. You're not gonna be alone. I'm making sure of it. And that's when Jesus has to break the bad news to Peter. That, well, Peter, before breakfast, you're actually gonna run away from me and then deny you even know me 3 times. And the rest of them too. And then they all start peppering Jesus with questions because they don't understand. Like, what about this Jesus? What about that Jesus? And show us this and then we'll believe or then we'll understand. And if you read John 13 and 14 and you read the way this supper goes around the table, you begin to wonder, couldn't Jesus have found better people? Couldn't he have found people who were sharper to bring into that room so they could plan how the church would go and grow after everything he was about to go through and after he left them? Couldn't he have gotten smarter people who would get it to bring into that room? Because these guys are a mess and they don't understand what's going on. And human messes are eventually what destroy communities and nations and organizations and even churches when they're built on human love. They can't stand to the brokenness of our brokenness, our selfishness, our sinfulness, our injustice, our wickedness. But when it came to the church, what Jesus was doing there was building it on this one simple command to love one another with a new expression of love that the world hadn't really seen before. And that was Jesus himself, a divine love that could overcome all of it, that was about to overcome all of it on the cross, that makes this love different than any other love. And so what I want us to do is take a couple moments now and say, okay, we see the room, we see the picture, what's different about Jesus' love here? And here's how I would say it in one sentence. If you're gonna just try and remember one sentence today, remember this one sentence. Jesus' love, based on this incident here, Jesus' love doesn't ask who. And that means two things. First, Jesus' love doesn't ask, do you know who I am? That's not what Jesus does. Some of the best songs we have are the old songs, right? I don't mean 50s and 60s. I don't mean going back to the Gaither hymnal. I'm thinking about 2,000 years ago. There's a song that we have written that Paul wrote in his letter to the Philippians. It's one of the first songs that we know of that the church used to worship with. The very first Christians used to worship with this song. We don't have the tune, we just have the lyrics. They're not gonna rhyme because I'm reading them in English. They were written in Greek, and rhyming wasn't that big a deal to them at that point. So this is a song about how to be the community of God. And this is how it goes. It starts with, in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, didn't consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. So Jesus didn't just say, okay, everybody, I want you to be nice, I want you to be the church, but you gotta go love each other. Jesus did it. He came and demonstrated a love that you and I can barely even fathom, and then calls us to follow him. Jesus went first. So whenever you and I find this command difficult, we need to remember that Jesus didn't just say to us, love one another. He showed us this love. He demonstrated this love. Whenever you find it to be too much, to be too much of a strain on you, go back and remember, Jesus didn't just tell you to do it. He did it first. He loved you with this love first so that you'd have what you need to then go give it. That's the kind of God we serve. This is the kind of God I've given my life to follow and love and serve in response to him, because this is the way God has always been. You go back to the Ten Commandments. Do you remember the beginning of the Ten Commandments? A lot of people who've read the Bible will start with, yeah, you have no other gods before me. But that's not the beginning of the Ten Commandments. That's the first commandment. But before God says that, he says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. In other words, I am the one who loved you, who descended into your trouble and rescued you from it. I demonstrated love to you. Now you go and live out that love. That's the kind of God we serve. When it comes to loving us, God doesn't say, do you know who I am? As though, like, why should I have to stoop down and love you? That's not what God is like. He has shown from the very beginning that he loves us by coming alongside of us. He loves us. What's so radical about this new love we see, this new command, is Jesus descending and becoming one of us, descending all the way into the pit that we dug with our sin so that we can be lifted up out of it. That's the kind of love Jesus calls us to. Do you know why our country struggles? And our world struggles? Because anytime anyone shows this kind of stooping love, this kind of love that bends down and stoops to help others, there's 100 people who stomp on that person's back to promote themselves. That is the nature of our world. That is the nature of our politics. That is why election seasons are so vile and disgusting and should turn our stomachs, because the nature of the way our world works, or our politics work, our nation works many times, is this pushing others down and aside and trying to tear them apart in order to promote myself. It is the opposite of this love that Jesus demonstrated to us. The opposite of this love that never asks, you know who I am, I shouldn't have to do this. This love that stoops down. That's why our nation is so broken. Our world is so broken. Maybe your workplace is like that too. Maybe you see it there at work. Maybe you've gotten caught up in it at times. Feels like I've got to do that in order to survive. I could never live out this love that of Jesus and you know, not protect myself. What if the church, though, what if we as followers of Jesus actually obeyed this command, this one command that he gave, to love one another as he loved us? What if our love never asked, do you know who I am? The second aspect of this idea that Jesus' love never asked who is not just, do you know who I am? It's, do you, or who are you, is the second part of it. Who are you? Who are you that I should love you? Jesus' love didn't ask that question. Who are you that I should love you? Jesus didn't wait for Judas to leave, right, before washing their feet. Jesus washed their feet when Judas was there. He washed Judas' feet knowing what Judas was about to do. He didn't say, who are you that I should love you? You're the jerk who's gonna go betray me in a little bit. No, he washed Judas' feet. He didn't get to Peter and Peter's like, no. And Jesus didn't say, fine, you're right, Peter, I should skip you. Because you know what you're gonna do in a little while? You're gonna run away and then you're gonna say you don't know me three times. No, Jesus washed his feet knowing full well what he would do and who he was and the mess he was. And he washed all of their feet knowing full well the mess they all were and what they would do. Jesus' love didn't ask, who are you? Who are you that I should love you, that you should get my love? Now, I know this one is probably the one that's more scary to us at times, to not ask, who are you? To not find ways to hold back love is difficult for us because we're set up to defend ourselves. We come up with reasons to withhold love the way the rest of the world does. And yet, I think we need to be confronted about that today and learn and weigh, how should we love without asking, who are you, the way Jesus did? I think one excuse that we come up with that gets in the way of us loving this way is we don't want to encourage or condone certain behaviors, right, that people are engaged in. You know, and we get this idea, if I love them, if I show them love, then I'm supporting them. I'm you know, condoning the life they're living. I'm signaling that what they're doing is fine. Well, that doesn't match up with Jesus in the way he showed love, because Jesus, by showing love to Judas and serving him, wasn't saying, and it's fine that you're gonna betray me. That's your choice. You know, if you wanna live that way, okay. No, there was no condoning. He wasn't saying to Peter, oh, you know, Peter, it's okay if you go and deny you know me. No big deal, I still love you. No, his love didn't depend on that, but it certainly wasn't saying it's fine to do it. Same thing for the disciples. He wasn't saying it's fine to go run away and betray me and leave me alone. No, there's this false dichotomy that's grown up in our culture that we often buy into today, that love means complete acceptance, and anything short of complete acceptance means hate. This idea that, if you love me, you'll accept and condone the choices I make and support me. And if you don't do that, then you hate me, or you must be a hater, or you don't like me. That love means that I just a blanket stamp of approval on my life. That could not be further from the truth. That's actually a horrible lie. That love means to always just condone everything a person's doing. I read a story the other day about a woman news reporter, and she got a tweet or an email or something from a fan, someone who was used to watching her and had been watching her on the news for a year or so, and noticed like a lump on her neck. And she had noticed it kind of growing over time. So she sent a message to her saying, hey, I noticed that lump on your neck. Now, the reporter could have, you know, being very conscious about how she looked, could have said, how dare you say that to me? How dare you, you know, point out that there's a lump on my neck, you know, and make me feel bad about myself. But the lady told her, said, look, you know, I had a similar lump and it turned out to be cancer. So you might want to go check that out. And the reporter lady did. She went and got it checked out and it turned out that it was cancerous, but they caught it in time and they were able to treat her. And she turned out to be fine because that woman loved her enough to tell her, that doesn't look right. You might want to think about getting that checked out and doing something about that. And if that's true for physical sickness, that it's the loving thing to do to tell someone when you see something, then how could it not be true for spiritual sickness or relational sickness or intellectual sickness? How could it not be true that what real love does is it points out and says, hey, you might want to get that looked at. You might want to think about that. That could be a real problem in your life. God has something much better for you than that. Real love does what Jesus did. It serves people and strives for their best without condoning sin and selfishness and or any of that stuff. But it doesn't withhold serving just because the person has a bad lifestyle. Second excuse we sometimes throw out there is, yeah, but what about if people see me with them, they're gonna think I'm like them, you know, the whole guilt by association thing, right? If I love them, people will think I'm one of them. Jesus actually went through this quite a lot. People accusing him of being a drunkard because he hung out with people who drank. Not because he drank and got drunk, but because he wasn't afraid to go be with people who were drunkards. He wasn't afraid to go be with people who were prostitutes or caught in sin or considered filthy or dirty or outcasts. He wasn't afraid to go be with them, even though it made the people who were righteous look down on him and say, "How you must be this way because you're with them." Jesus didn't care about what they tweeted about him. He wasn't rushing to his phone to say, what are they saying on Facebook because they saw me there talking to that person. He didn't care about the judgment that comes from any other place. He only cared about the judgment that came from God the Father. That God the Father would look and say, "Yes, you're doing the work I've given you to do. You're loving the way I've sent you to love." That's all he cared about. You and I need to follow that same love that doesn't ask, "Who are you?" and allow someone's sin to become an obstacle to loving them. Jesus never let a person's sin or brokenness keep him from treating them with love. Here's the hard question, though, because for you and I, we're not Jesus. That's obviously true. And so there are times when maybe we're going and spending time with people because we're lured to be like them. So here's the heart question you and I need to ask to evaluate ourselves when it comes to loving people and not condoning what they do or not being guilt by association. We need to ask, are you with them because you want to be like them, or are you with them because you want to be like Jesus? That's the question you and I should ask, right? Whoever the them is, and you can fill in that group on your own. Are you with them because you want to be like them, or are you with them because you're being like Jesus and Jesus has led you to them? That's the question that should help you and I parse out whether we're giving in to temptation versus we're truly following Jesus and loving with his love. Jesus' love doesn't ask, "Who are you? Are you clean enough for me to love?" Doesn't ask that. It also doesn't ask, "Who are you? Are you safe enough for me to love?" One of the biggest excuses we make is the excuse that, well, what if they hurt me, or what if they fail me, or they already have hurt me, they already have failed me, so I withhold my love because I'm afraid of that. I don't want to give love to someone and they don't give it back, and now I feel bad about myself. Now I feel hurt. There's an interesting glimpse we get into Jesus' mind right at the beginning of the Last Supper, right as John's writing the beginning of chapter 13, right before he washes Judas' feet and Peter's feet and all the feet of all the people who are about to leave him and abandon him and betray him. Just as he's about to go and die for this world, because he loves us and our response is going to be kill him, right? Just before all that happens, Jesus, here's what he's thinking. Here's what's going on in his mind. John 13, verse 3 through 4. This tells us where his hope was. It says, Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up, took off his cloak, put on the towel, got the basin and started washing feet and serving, and then went and climbed up on the cross, was beaten, was abused, was murdered and crucified and tortured, all of it because he knew who he was and he knew where he was going. He was confident in the love of God the Father, and that gave him the security he needed to love, even though he knew the people he was loving were going to hurt him. It's not a question of will someone hurt you? Maybe they will, maybe they won't. It's just a question of when, right? Anyone you pour out love on is going to hurt you at some point. Any person is going to fail you. They're going to neglect you. They're going to hurt your feelings. They're going to leave you out. They're going to maybe go against you on something. There's no way around that being the truth. And so if our love is based on only loving people who are going to reciprocate love in at least an even way, then we're not loving with Jesus' love, and we'll never be the church Jesus called us to be. Instead, the love that Jesus modeled for us doesn't ask who. It doesn't ask, are you the kind of person who will reciprocate this love back to me, or are you going to hurt me? We don't worry about that because we're so secure in God's love for us because of what Jesus did for us that I'm able to love even though I know you're going to hurt me and let me down. And you're able to love me even though you know I'm going to hurt you and let you down. That's the kind of love Jesus loved with. That's the kind of love he calls on us to pour out on each other. Worship team, would you come back? Jesus' love never asked who. It's the kind of love that it takes to build the church, to hold us together, to hold the church around the world together. It's this kind of love, this love that defies the dividing lines that we all draw around ourselves and each other. It defies all of that by not asking the question, do you know who I am? Or the question, who are you? Are you good enough? It doesn't stand for those questions. He just pours out his love. It's a love that shatters our excuses for withholding love. It's the love, it's the only love that's powerful enough to join us together in an unbreakable bond, even in the face of our sin and our brokenness and our failure and our selfishness. That's how powerful this love is that we've been given. And we can love with this love because Jesus gave it to us. This is the love he gave us. This is the love he commanded us to practice. What does all that mean in an election year when our country is ripping apart at the seams? What does it mean in a pandemic year when everyone is so frustrated? What does it mean in a year when the roosters of racism have come home to roost and the seams of our nation are fraying and tearing apart and there's anger and hurt flying around and heads hanging in shame and realizing there's people, brothers and sisters who've been hurting and we've been ignoring them? And then there's others who want to deny that and others who just want to cause chaos. What does this love look like in a world that is descending into chaos and sin? Are we doomed to just follow it? Or are we the church so empowered by this love, Jesus' love, not love the way the world talks about Jesus' love, that we actually will grow closer together while everyone else is falling apart and tearing apart, that we'll actually shine into this world so that everyone looks at us and says, wow, that's the love I've been looking for. A love that doesn't ask who, but a love that just the same draws people up out of sin, that grips our hearts, draws them up out of ways of living that are destructive and painful and hurtful, and leads them into the life Jesus gave us. I believe the church doesn't have to go the way the rest of the world goes. We can grab hold of this command Jesus gave us, and we can live out this love. And when we do, it will revive this world that is dying. It'll breathe a life into this world that will transform it. Let's take a few moments before we celebrate communion and let's sing about that. Let's ask for that, Jesus. We want to see you lifted high. We want to see your name exalted in the highest. So stand with me if you're home, if you're here. Stand up and let's sing this song. Glory to you, God, in the highest. Bring peace to this earth. Bring your love.